This is Jameson Morton, and you're listening to Legalist Rainmaker Podcast, where we interview attorneys at top law firms about how they made partner. Our guest today on the podcast is Andrew Fletcher, partner at Blank Rome. With over 25 years of experience, Andy has tried cases in numerous federal and state courts, as well as in international and U.S. arbitrations. Andy, it's great to have you on the podcast. Could you start us off with an overview of your firm and your practice as a whole?
Blank Rome is a national law firm with offices across the country, over 600 lawyers in the firm. My practice focuses on business litigation with a special focus on business trials. I have extensive experience actually trying cases to verdict. So I handle cases in all kinds of jurisdictions geographically, as well as all types of different fora. So that would include state court bench and jury trials, federal court bench and jury trials, arbitrations in the U.S., and arbitrations overseas, also known as international arbitration.
Great. So, Andy, one thing unique about your practice is that you've tried cases all over the world, including Sweden, the U.K., and India. You know, has any of that international exposure changed you as a litigator? You know, are there any lessons learned from that experience?
Well, the cases that I've been involved in, you just named the places where they were conducted. So of those cases, only one was actually against a foreign sovereign. That was a case against the trading company for the government of the Russian Federation. Mm-hmm. But the answer to your question is, how does it impact my work as a litigator? Is that when you spend time in other jurisdictions working with their law and working with their cultures, it focuses you on how to understand your audience, specifically in arbitrations, the audience is the arbitrators, and understand your clients and their business. You know, oftentimes there's cultural issues that require translation. But in every case, there are cultural issues that require translation to your audience. So in a jury trial, your audience is a judge and jury. In a bench trial, your audience is, of course, the judge. But you have to understand when you're litigating that you are trying to communicate ideas on behalf of your client. So my time spent overseas has really focused me on how we're all different, but we're all the same. So we use different terminology. There's cultural issues that impact how people communicate. And if you work through those, you can effectively communicate without letting your method get in the way of your message.
Huh. That's very interesting. So do you have an example of a cultural difference that you overcame for a case?
Sure. You know, the Russian Federation historically has been a trading economy, you know, barter economy. And by historically, I mean dating back centuries. Whereas mm-hmm. in the U.S. and the U.K. as well, the U.K. is very much a mercantile economy. And so the sanctity of contract is well recognized and well respected in mercantile economies because you make big investments based on contractual promises. And so the idea that if someone breaches a contract, you get compensation is well understood culturally because the economy depends on being able to rely on the expectations that are set forth in contracts. In trading economies, it's much more situational. So the question is, well, do I need you today? I know I signed this contract with you, but that's when I needed something from you. Things have changed. And because of those changes, I don't want to be in relationship with you anymore. So they don't communicate it in those words. But what happens is, you know, the respect for the enforceability of certain contract provisions, as an example, is different in that culture than it is in a mercantile culture. Now, when you're litigating, of course, you're dealing with a uniform body of law, and you're dealing with, in the case of a contract, a specific contract. So people can't use those words. They can't say, oh, well, things change, so I don't need you anymore, so I'm just not going to abide by the contract. I mean, they make up arguments as to why they haven't breached, that sort of thing. But that's an example of a cultural difference that you need to understand where they're coming from to kind of drive at, you know, in the case of where that's your opponent, drive at the cross-examination and the argument against their position.
Yeah, absolutely. And that goes to show the intimate relationship between culture and law, which is just fascinating. But focusing more on your practice, Andy, one of your specialties is in trade secret litigation. What are some of the industry trends you're seeing? You know, now that everything's online, has technology made it easier for people to steal trade secrets?
I haven't specifically seen an increase in trade secret cases as a result of, we'll call it espionage. But I do think that trade secret law is becoming increasingly important in the modern technology economy, because the ways you can protect intellectual property are, you know, you have trademark law that addresses trademark and trade dress. That's really the law around branding. You have copyright law that protects specific expressions. You have patent law, which prevents inventions. And then you have trade secret law, which protects information that is valuable to your business, that is known only to you, and which you take appropriate steps to maintain its secrecy. And the reason I think that there's going to be a shift and an increase in trade secret protection, and then eventually there'll be an increase in trade secret cases, is that between the Congress and the Supreme Court, the scope of patent law has been narrowed over the last 10 years. The America Invents Act introduced a lot of changes to patent law and how what is patentable. And then there are some significant decisions issued by the Supreme Court, which boil down to the proposition, you can't get a patent for something just because you use a computer for it. If it was something that the computer does better and faster, but it was otherwise known, the law now is you can't get a patent for that. So that's significant, because a lot of what goes on in tech-enabled businesses is essentially exactly that which the Supreme Court said you can't get a patent on. So if the value of your business is tied up with how effectively you've tech-enabled that business, then keeping your methodology secret and, you know, maintaining that secrecy is going to become increasingly valuable for people who are in the tech business.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, on the other hand, you've represented multiple plaintiffs in the energy sector, mostly having to do with gas, oil, and mineral rights in the Marcellus Shale, you know, where fracking is actually used to extract those resources. With the growing controversy around fracking in recent years, have you seen an increase in cases of that area or of that nature?
So there's definitely been an increase in the litigation, because the Marcellus Shale, the development of the Marcellus Shale in western Pennsylvania, running diagonally across Pennsylvania and up into Marcellus, New York, is a once in a 100 years type development in terms of technology improvement and resource development. The natural gas reserves that are in the Marcellus Shale, it's mind-boggling how much natural gas is there and is being extracted. So that the economic activity that sprung up around that has generated a lot of litigation, because it's the standard types of things that you run into anytime there's heavy economic growth. As things go wrong or people change their plans or whatnot, you end up in things breaking, contracts being breached, need to hire new and different contractors, disputes over employment issues. It runs the entire gamut. Now, that market is now in a fairly prolonged downturn. And what I mean by prolonged is, over the last few years, the oil and gas market, because the prices have been so low, has been, you know, very much in a downturn. And that impacts legal activity because everybody is, you know, cutting costs. but it's an industry that's here to stay for the long term. So I expect there will continue to be a lot of legal activity around, you know, everything from, as you point out, fracking, drilling, and all of the services that are around transporting the gas to market.
Absolutely. Thanks for that insight. So coming to the title of our podcast, how did you first make partner and become a rainmaker?
I made partner at a litigation boutique in Philadelphia called Hangley, Aronchick, Siegel, and Pudlin. Now it's Hangley, Aronchick, Siegel, Pudlin, and Schiller. And that firm was very much focused on relatively small firm. When I joined the firm, there were about 25 lawyers or so, and focused on high-end complex litigation at a small firm, which gave me a lot of experience on my feet, handling things in court, handling depositions. Within 2 years of joining that firm as an associate, I tried my first jury trial, and I made partner there at the end of 1999.
Awesome. And given your experience, Andy, do you have any advice for associates? Some of them are, you know, vigorously pursuing partnership, but unclear about their paths.
The issue of making partners should be, young lawyers should focus on separating the issue of what the title is from what it is they're learning how to do. So what I've always advised young lawyers is to focus on the craft and focus on the profession and how they can grow their skill set as a lawyer. And if they decide it is they want to be, so partner is a label. Partner is obviously it's a standing within an enterprise. It means different things to different law firms. Obviously, it is also an indicia of success and seniority that you've gotten to the point where your law firm says, she has done such a good job. We want her to be our partner and we want to promote to the world that we have deemed her to be such a quality lawyer that she's a partner to our law firm. So it has great value for all of those reasons. But it isn't an end in itself. And the question young lawyers should be asking themselves is, who do I want to be as a professional, as a member of the professional community? How do I want to take advantage of the skill set that caused me to want to go to law school, to succeed at law school, to join this law firm? And if you're at a law firm where, after you go through that process, the firm is not aligned with what it is you need to find a different law firm where there's an alignment between how you want to grow as a lawyer and what the law firm is looking for in terms of your contribution to the enterprise. And once you do that, you focus on the profession and developing your skill set because you can control the inputs to that process, your enthusiasm, your work ethic, your energy, your attitude, your desire to solve problems. You can't control the outcomes, how the judge will rule, how the jury will return its verdict, whether the partner decides that she wants to have you take a more senior role. I mean, those are things out of your control. So you focus on the things that are in your control with a goal to developing your professional skill set, which will develop your professional profile, and good things will follow.
Yeah, that's a really good message, that becoming a partner is a result of successful alignment between your skills and the firm's needs. And like you said, making partner is not an end by itself. You still need to be able to develop and maintain a robust book of business. So, you know, my question, how did you manage that? How do you make sure you have a long-lasting book of business?
So the term book of business means different things to different people. So the answer to that question depends on what, you know, the answer to my my last answer that I gave you, which is to say, who do you want to be as a lawyer? So if you're interested in, you know, privacy and data protection, for example, then you want to be a litigator, then how are those cases litigated? Who are the types of clients that need those services? Are your relationships going to come from certain types of clients that are involved in that, for whom those are key issues. Is it your relationships going to be with insurance companies that are writing cybersecurity policies and going to be at the forefront of choosing who the litigators are? So your question was one about what's the path towards building a book of business? And the answer is, first you start with what it is you want to do as a lawyer in terms of your craft. Then you look at what you want to do in terms of industries or focus groups. And then you determine, well, who is in that space and how can I best serve the people who are in that space on a repeat basis? And then that creates the relationships where folks come back to you multiple times because you're their trusted advisor.
Absolutely. And thanks for that, Andy. So coming to the end of our conversation here, I want to ask your thoughts on litigation funding. In the past decade, you know, we've seen a dramatic growth on the litigation finance industry as a whole, partly because litigation has become so expensive. So what are your predictions for the future? Do you see litigation funding playing a big role in the legal industry?
I do think it's an important part of the future because of the reason you just described, which is the cost has gotten dramatic. I mean, it's increased dramatically over the last 10 years, and it's just accelerating. And what the litigation funding industry has done is create opportunities for a three-way partnership between the law firm or trial team, the funding litigation funder, and the client. And that gives clients, I think, an opportunity to breathe a little bit more easily in terms of what the cost of a case is going to be, depending on how you structure it, and also more freedom to pursue claims. I mean, I've typically seen it on the affirmative side, going to recover funds, but I know there's been a development in the industry of using it on for defensive purposes as well. And I think where that's going in the future is there's going to be an increasing emphasis on the use of technology in managing litigation, project management techniques, work with alternative service providers. All of these factors are going to come together over the next 5 to 10 years. And litigation funding is a key part of that because it creates the ability to have a partnership where you're not just looking at the client to have to fund the entire budget or the law firm to have to essentially finance something until there's a recovery. It's really picked up a lot of momentum, and I think that momentum is going to grow.
All right. Thanks for listening. Legalist is a tech-driven litigation finance firm that helps lawyers get paid. Rate our podcast and give us a review wherever you find your podcasts. See you next time.